And so I think one of the big problems there now with the grocery store sector has been its ability to push prices to such rock bottom levels that farmers have been left in a position where it's very hard to sustain what they're doing with the prices that they're receiving from the food system.
That's John Steinman, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. John Steinman is the producer and host of Deconstructing Dinner, the internationally syndicated radio show, podcast, and streaming television series. He's also the past director and president of Canada's largest independent retail consumer food co-op. He joins us to talk about his book, Grocery Story: The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
Give us an overview of this book. What are readers going to find here?
Well, you know, in a way, it's almost two books in one. The first part of the book is really an expose, if you will, on the grocery store sector as we've come to know it today. And I even go back into the history books and share the history of grocery retailing, particularly that of the big chains in the United States, and some also content from Canada. And I really wanted to go back to share, you know, this is how the chain grocers have evolved. So I go as far back as A&P 100 years ago and how they became really the first of the grocery giants. And so this is a big focus of the book, is looking how the grocery store sector evolved, how it's influenced the entirety of the food system. And what I also do in the book is present this interesting alternative that has existed now for well over 100 years, which is this cooperative model where people who are actually shopping at the store have the opportunity to own the grocery store they're shopping at. And this has come in waves over the past 100 years, where today we now have about 230 of these types of grocery stores. And so it's a really big picture book that looks at not only the big grocers operating in our communities, but these alternative models of grocery store ownership.
Well, let's start, first of all, with the dominant model that's out there right now, the retail food industry as it exists today. What do you see that's wrong with that model and how it's working?
Well, I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges with the grocery store sector as it's evolved today is that there are fewer and fewer companies that are controlling really the grocery store market. And it's one of these subjects that has been, I think, left out of the larger conversation around the future of food. You know, we tend to focus a lot of our attention when thinking of alternative food. We think of farmers markets and CSAs. And yet at the end of the day, so much of our food purchases are happening at grocery stores. And because there are fewer and fewer companies now controlling the sector, they have developed an immense power to really shape the future of food. In fact, as I write about in the book, the grocery store sector is responsible for literally shaping the food that we eat. The types of tomatoes, for example, we'll find on the grocery store shelf are really being bred at breeding centers all across the country to suit the needs of this long distance transportation model, of the needs of the consumer, for example, to pick a tomato that is 100% perfect, you know, that bomb-proof tomato that is the one we're going to select off the shelf. And so grocery stores not only are shaping food, but they're shaping really the prices that farmers are receiving for their food. And this is a focus of the book, is really how the grocery stores are determining the future of farming in America right now. And as we know, I think generally over the past few decades, farming in America has become a very difficult field to be in. Right now, we have about 75% of what are classified as small farms in the country relying on some form of off-farm income. And so I think one of the big problems there now with the grocery store sector has been its ability to push prices to such rock bottom levels that farmers have been left in a position where it's very hard to sustain what they're doing with the prices that they're receiving from the food system. You know, there was a time in the US where the people producing food, whether it was the primary producer at the farm or maybe it was a wholesaler or food manufacturer even, there was a time where these businesses, whether it was a farm or a food manufacturer, had many customers to choose from. There was a diversity of markets to sell into, whether it was an independent grocer or a small regional chain. And this gave that sector of the food system quite a lot of resilience by having that many customers to sell into. And because there are now fewer and fewer companies for these food businesses to sell into, it's become less of a supplier-dominated food system and more of a buyer dominated food system. And so really it's those who are buying the food, which at the end of the day are the big grocers, who are really setting the agenda for the food system. And one of the examples I share in the book, which I think is a really good one, is if you look back 100 years to the beginning of A&P, there was a case with the Cream of Wheat breakfast cereal company where they were selling boxes of cereal to all of their customers, thousands of them, for 11 cents a box. And they had been asking their customers to resell it on the shelf for 14 cents. And A&P, as they grew at the time 100 years ago with about 5,000 locations, they decided to undercut their competition and sell that box of cereal for 12 cents, so a 1 cent markup. And this infuriated Cream of Wheat because for Cream of Wheat, they realized that all of their other customers were going to suffer from this. And so Cream of Wheat did something that many food manufacturers today would likely not be able to do. Cream of Wheat simply turned off the tap and stopped selling their cereal to A&P. And today, many food manufacturers and food makers of all kinds don't have that capacity to turn off the tap anymore because they only have what often is a few or a handful of companies to sell to.
So let's talk about the alternative here, the food co-ops. Why do you believe that that's a better alternative?
For your listeners who are unfamiliar with the cooperative model, it's a model that's been used in many sectors of the economy now for well over 100 years. In grocery, it's a model that's been used to allow for the people who are shopping at the store to literally become a shareholder, an owner in the store. And no one owner of the store has any more power than any other owner. So it's a very democratic, horizontal, if you will, ownership structure that enables, again, the people shopping at the store to be an owner. So for example, I'm an owner in my grocery store, along with 13,000 other people. And I think one of the misconceptions too with this model is that, well, that then makes the grocery store exclusive to just those people who are shareholders. And that's not the case. In fact, all co-ops, with the exception of a few, are open to anybody to walk into the store. So it's open to customers and it's open to people who are members. And so as a member, an owner of my grocery store, I get to vote for my board of directors once a year. And so it's really taking these ideals of the democratic model and really democratizing the economy and placing that within, in this case, the grocery store sector.
Now, earlier, we were talking about how the big retail grocery stores have had such an impact on agriculture and how it limits their markets. But do the food co-ops provide an opportunity then for smaller farmers to provide their product to these co-ops?
Yeah, well, this is generally what I focus on in my book, is how over time food co-ops have really developed much stronger relationships with food producers. And particularly, they're not requiring a lot of onerous fees and hoops to jump through in order to get that food into those stores. And so what we find in some co-ops, like I feature in the book, is upwards of 40% of the foods being sold at the store are coming from the local area or region. Often what co-ops define as local is anywhere from 100 miles to 150 miles from the store. And one of the important distinctions now that's happening within the grocery store sector is food co-ops, which have long used that as the definition for local, are now competing with a very different form of local that's emerging among many of the big grocers. I've spent many days now walking into some of the grocers here in the US, the big chains, and looking at the way in which local, the definition of local, is being changed. And so there's an example for, as one example out of Michigan, Meijer, a very large grocery giant there, has decided that for them, local is an entire region of six states, which includes Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana. And they've decided that local for them is this huge region of the country. And so that really challenges the ideas of local that many food makers, whether they're local or more regional, have been relying on as something to set themselves apart from other foods. And so co-ops really are trying to maintain a very different version of that local. And you'll generally find, you know, a very open door to the people who are producing food in the area surrounding that community-owned grocery store, the food co-op.
Now, the food co-op, you also indicate in the book, helps with low-income food access. Tell us a bit about that.
There's sort of two streams to that. One is there is this emerging interest among communities where they might be what could be classified by the USDA as a food desert. So this would be an area that is devoid of any full service grocery store whatsoever, particularly in this case in lower income communities. And there are many now communities across the country that are looking at the cooperative model as one of a few options to bring a grocery store into those areas. And it's in its early stages, you know, so I write about a few examples in the book. In fact, one example that I was writing about that succeeded in Greensboro, North Carolina, into opening a store in one of these designated food deserts, sadly closed its doors just this past January. And so it's a model that's still sort of being tested. You know, could we use this cooperative model where, again, people in the community can own their grocery store? Could we use it for this purpose? There are some examples where this has succeeded. There in Kansas, in the community of Morin, there was a grocer there that had to close up because the owners of that independent grocer were retiring, and the community banded together to form the Marmaton Market, which is now a cooperatively owned grocery store. And so there is one success story there in Kansas where this model has been applied. And what many food co-ops are also doing is they're trying to make their food more accessible to all levels of income. So I was just in Durham, North Carolina, where there's a co-op there that is offering 20% off everything in the store every day to anyone who qualifies for any number of low-income assistance programs. And at that co-op there, there are about 450 of their members who are using that program. And so it's an incredible example of a way that a grocery store can be accessible to as many people as possible. And in this case, foods that are more often healthier, foods that are more often coming from the local area, and trying to make those foods available to people.
What is the takeaway for readers of this book? What do you want them to do with the information you provide?
Well, you know, I offer some suggestions at the end of the book, but I think overall what I'm hoping this book can do is really just inject into this bigger conversation about the future of food some considerations for people to, first off, understand how the grocery stores operate. I'm hoping people can understand that whereas we walk into a grocery store and think that we are choosing what's available and voting with our dollar, there are a whole lot of practices happening, including the shelves of our grocery stores now being up for sale to the largest food manufacturers on the planet. And so whoever can afford to purchase those shelves at the grocery store are the foods that we're going to end up seeing in our grocery store. And so that's just one example that I'm hoping people can be aware of. And as we become more aware of how the grocery stores operate, I'm hoping people have the information available to make a decision as to whether or not this is the model that we want to keep investing in, or if we'd like to start to invest into a different future, which is, I think, one that is most sustainable through investing in cooperatively owned grocery stores. And so whether it's finding a grocery store that's cooperatively owned in your community, or whether it's considering starting one on their own, which right now there's over 100 of them in some form of development in the country. I'm hoping really that's what people are going to take out of reading this book.
Well, John, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for your interest in this subject.
John Steinman's book is Grocery Story: The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.